You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Okay, hello. I think we're patched in. Kara, can you hear us? Hello, Kara.
Yes, I can hear you. I'm here, guys.
Oh, great, great. Bob, Jay, and I are all here together.
Barely.
In the SGU tornado bunker.
Oh, man.
Somewhere deep underground.
Can you hear those winds? I mean, it's unbelievable. Kara, I don't even know how we managed to patch you in, because Connecticut has been destroyed by hundreds of tornadoes, apparently, because there's trees up and cars flipped over and, you know, it's pandemonium over here.
Some damn good Wi-Fi you got.
We have a Wi-Fi tower that we're tapping into. We're very resourceful.
Good, good.
So yeah, we'll do anything to get the show out. We haven't missed a show in 13 years. Tornadoes are not going to stop us.
Apparently it took Evan away, though.
It did.
Evan is still missing in action.
Yeah, we don't even know where he is. We haven't heard from him since the tornadoes landed.
Yeah, that's an acceptable loss, though.
Jeez, yeah, don't tell him that.
We'll take a 20% hit.
So the truth is, so today is Thursday.
Love you, Evan.
We normally record on Wednesday night.
Which wasn't happening.
That was not going to happen. Yeah. Because Tuesday, we all got an alert on our cell phones that said tornado warning.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like the old TV thing where you hear like a beep and you got to go and you got to see the message. And
what's funny, so we've had tornado watches a lot. Like every year there's at least one tornado watch. It never turns into anything. So I basically ignore them. Yeah. And I didn't notice at this time it was a tornado warning.
Yes.
Which is completely different. A tornado watch means the weather is conducive to tornadoes. A tornado warning is, we've seen a tornado.
Well, the Doppler radar is showing the
either on Doppler
of
or by either way. Either
yeah,
Doppler,
there's rotation.
There is a tornado.
Yeah. When I was growing up in Texas, we would have a watch like every other weekend. So same kind of thing. Like you're like, okay, there's a chance, but whatever. You just ignore it. But when there's a tornado warning, that's when you either like go on your front lawn and crack a beer or go hide in your bathtub. It depends on the personality type you have. So,
or go mow your lawn like that guy did in that famous picture.
Talk about balls on that guy.
Best picture ever, though.
Yeah. So, yeah, I got the warning. Jay called me. I'm on my way home. And luckily, I just barely made it home, because otherwise I would have been dodging trees, you know. Yeah. It was really, really bad.
Oh, you made it home? Isn't that awesome for you?
Yeah. Wow. Oh, no, Bob, what happened?
Bob didn't make it home.
Didn't make it.
My wife never made it home that night.
What? Where did all these people end up?
In the hotels.
The rapidly dwindling hotel rooms. We got like the last one in the entire area, I think. Everyone was filled up. Everybody was.
Wow.
It was bizarre.
Like right now, we're in Steve's hotel room.
I'm in the hotel room that my wife had to get. Yeah. So almost immediately after I get home, and luckily my daughters were home as well. So everyone was there except for my wife wasn't there yet. And then, like, it was sunny skies like 20 minutes earlier.
Yeah.
The skies were already turning really, really dark. And then I'm like, oh yeah, guys, we have a tornado warning. And then it like instantly started pouring. No build up, just like boom, just like boom, the rain started pouring. And then the wind hit 20 seconds later. And the whole thing lasted like 10 minutes and then it was over.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you guys get hail too?
It was far and away the most intense wind I've ever personally experienced.
Ooh.
But not only that, the wind was whipping around the house. Like normally we've had hurricanes before. We have winter storms. The wind's blowing in one direction.
Yeah.
It may shift.
Sure.
But it's blowing in one direction at a time. Not this. This was literally, the wind was whipping around. You could see the winds, the trees swirling.
There
was no consistent direction.
Did you see, a witch flying around the house?
Yeah, right? Wow, I wouldn't have been surprised.
So I had to drive to Steve's house to pick up our remote audio equipment so we could do the recording right here, right? Because we're not going to bring our rigs home.
Like, yeah.
Right now, it's as if we're at a conference in a sense.
Yeah.
So first of all, like, half of his road is just covered in trees. You have to zigzag to get up to get to the top.
You got a serpentine.
There were trees that literally were uprooted and blown over, like dozens of them on his street.
Yeah.
So what you see?
Yeah, you posted a picture on Facebook, right? That's what it looks like.
That was just
on your
one
street.
Shot of many.
But a tornado touched down on Steve's street.
What?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, we were right in the path.
Yep.
What are you talking about? That is so insane.
Are your neighbors all okay?
So there were, on your street?
There were four confirmed tornadoes in this storm system. One touchdown in Oxford, where Jay lives.
That's right.
One touchdown in Hamden, where I lived.
And Larry, our friend Larry, didn't he?
One in New Fairfield, yeah.
New Fairfield, and then
it's
there was
like a, we're being targeted.
And Brookfield, yeah. There was a macro burst or whatever in Brookfield.
The one in
New Hampden, they said like it was a 2.3 mile or whatever, a 6 mile path. Clearly, you could see the path of destruction. It clearly went through my neighborhood.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to see an aerial shot of this.
Hey, Bob.
I'd love to see it too, yeah.
Bob, do you remember how last week you were asking why anybody would ever live in a natural disaster zone?
Well, no, and I specifically said, yeah, Connecticut is safe.
Yeah, we're weather here.
Yeah, we don't get shit like tornadoes in Connecticut. No.
Clearly, the gods were listening. But still, that just proves my point, really. Because if we experience this on even an annual basis, I would be so gone. Because this is nuts. This is crazy.
So let me tell
you. You get used to it.
Kara, here's my quick story.
Yep.
So I was paying heed to the warnings because it wasn't like, again, it said tornado, you know, imminent tornado.
You had 10 minutes warning.
Yeah.
Which is average. The average length of a warning before a tornado today is 13 minutes.
Which is great. It's so much better than earthquake warnings. Continue.
My wife and I, the whole day, we were power washing our deck. And oh God, is that a terrible job, by the way. But anyway,
Why? It's just really dirty.
It's like you just get soaked and you get whatever you're power washing off your deck, you're covered in. So anyway.
But why did you choose to do that on a storm day?
It wasn't a storm day until that hit, though.
Yeah, I mean, it was fine.
I see.
10 minutes before the storm came, it was relatively sunny out.
Yeah, it's not like a hurricane where you know it's heading towards you. This was just like things were fine and then tornado warning and there's a tornado. Literally no warning.
Typically with things that I don't like because I'm morbidly – you know, kind of obsessed with tornadoes, but they're scary. They're very scary.
Oh,
so
of course.
I'm out in the front lawn and I see the tornado storm front come in and then everything turns green. And every time I've been in a tornado district, you know, tornado is imminent to happen. Everything does turn green and I still haven't read why. I would love to know why.
It's not always the case. I did a lot of research on this back when I did a show on the Weather Channel called The Truth About Twisters. Weirdly, it's not always the case, but there are a lot of reports of people seeing green before tornadoes. I did too, like very commonly. But apparently the data don't show that the sky always turns green before a tornado. It's sort of all over the place.
It turns dark. And I think people interpret that as a turning green.
Wall clouds usually, or, you know, oftentimes you can see the wall clouds. So it's this bizarre kind of these white clouds that are really formidable and like reflecting a lot of the light in a strange way that you're not accustomed
to.
Yeah,
I think that's what I agree with you. And I think, you know, because there's a lot of greenery, you know, maybe that's what it is. But anyway, so now I see the storm front coming in and there's a lot of low clouds with tornadoes. Every time I've been there, you see like this low, like the low clouds are moving faster than the high clouds. So you can just see the layers, right? So I immediately go back to the back door and I say, Corp, grab the kids. We got to go downstairs in the basement. The storm front is here. And then as Steve described, it hit instantly. We had a little wash of hail. This is in seconds, by the way. So I grab my wife and I'm like, drop everything in your hands now. Like now we're yelling because all of a sudden the wind is up and I'm yelling at her.
Yeah.
I pull her and 100-foot tall tree that's in my yard just falls over about a quarter of the way up. That's where it broke. And then I was 15 feet from it and it just goes rant and it falls over and it misses my house and it misses my deck and it misses my shed. And it just goes right down, like right where
and it missed you by like what? 20 degrees?
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
It's exactly where, if I hired a company to take it down, that's where they would have dropped it. It went right there. I couldn't believe it. Then I had a tree uprooted.
Oh, my gosh, that's so scary.
Another tree in my front yard. All in all, I lost 9 trees in my yard, and I have more.
Wow.
I don't even know. Like, I bought a chainsaw, but, like, it could take me 2 months to clear this. It's an enormous
amount of work. I talked to our lawn guy today. If you want to pay somebody to cut and haul that stuff out, it depends how big the job is and the type of tree, the nature of the tree, but it could be anywhere from many hundreds to thousands of dollars.
Sure.
One guy, the lawn guy I talked to, is going to spend $15,000 on tree removal. $15,000 on tree removal. Now, hearing your stories, guys, it actually upsets me because I was an hour away in Stanford at work. Didn't have any idea what was going on.
Yeah.
No idea the extent of it until it was well done. And I'm kind of pissed that I missed like this, like twice a century weather aberration. I've never experienced anything like this.
Yep.
And I love rare stuff and I missed something awesome.
I lived through an earthquake and a tornado, which I know are nothing for you, Texan California, but as an execution, experiencing both an earthquake and a tornado is unusual. So, yeah, my neighborhood is trashed. The house across from the street from me had a tree go through their roof.
It
was
raining.
It
got so dangerous.
Yeah, it got breached, and then rain just poured through the breach. Luckily, I have no tall trees in my yard. There is no tree that can fall on my house, so my house is fine. We lost one shutter.
But Steve, a tornado can throw a tree.
I know, a more powerful tornado.
Yeah.
The thing is, as tornadoes go, this was not a powerful tornado. They rated it as an EF1, which means...
F1, all right.
They estimated the winds at 110 miles per hour, which is fast for here, but that's, you know, it goes all the way up to 5, you know, like 200 miles per hour.
Like, there are tornadoes that have, like, you know, a half mile.
Yeah, so this
radius.
Was not a powerful enough tornado that the tornado itself would destroy a house.
Yeah.
It wouldn't pick up cars. It wouldn't pick up trees. And we know, like in Tornado Alley, they get tornadoes where, you know, there are trees flying through your house. Here, all of the damage was done by falling trees getting blown over. But we're in Connecticut, as you so adorably say, Kara, we live in the woods, right?
You live in the forest, yeah.
And so there are trees everywhere, and there are trees down everywhere. You're trying to drive down the street, and every 50 feet, 20 feet, there is a tree across the road. There's a tree...
On the power lines.
On the power lines. There are power lines down, power lines draping across the road everywhere, everywhere. We could not get off our street for a day.
Yeah.
We're still driving through a maze to get through our neighborhood, going around, you know, these paths and dodging, you know, fallen trees and stuff. This is with a couple days of removal. We're still not, we can't just drive where we want to go.
Yeah, it goes to show how important it is for like, or how sort of neighborhoods even. We often talk about like the biology of evolution and how organisms evolve within their ecological niches. But as human beings, we've built infrastructure within the environmental niche where we live. And so you guys are not used to this.
We are
and
not
it wreaked
rigged for
absolute
tornadoes.
Havoc. Yeah. Whereas in the South, it does wreak havoc, but it's a different way because we're used to certain types of wind. I mean, I see this really interesting phenomenon in Los Angeles. So a lot of people don't know this, but there are no native palm trees in Los Angeles. All the palm trees that you see when you come visit were imported from like Mexico. They're actually kind of a nuisance, and there are a lot of environmentalists who want to see them go away. When we have the Santa Ana winds, these insanely high winds that come whipping around the city on quite a regular basis, the city is littered with these massive palm fronds that completely disrupt traffic. You can't get around them. It's the same thing when we have heavy rains. The city shuts down when we have heavy rains because we don't have the infrastructure to deal with all the flooding. But when I was growing up in Texas, there were storm drains everywhere, rained constantly. A little rain never got in the way of anything. And then
I know.
It's like nobody can drive.
When a southern city gets like an inch of snow, they're paralyzed. You know?
Oh, yeah,
we
completely.
Because
right. We don't have
them.
And salt, then we don't have snow, we don't have anything.
To us, especially in Canada, they think we're lame.
Yeah.
What? Yeah.
You got 3 feet of snow and your city's paralyzed? What's going on? You guys are so lame.
Right, but it's all relative.
But now remember, this is not what we're talking about here. Having just any F1, F.3, if that even exists, even having that is rare where we are. It's very rare. The last one I remember, a real bona fide tornado, was like 20 years ago, right?
Yeah.
It was a long time ago. Now, this was a system that spawned not one, but multiple. And now Steve, between Steve J and me, we're like, you know, 45 minutes to an hour away from each other. This was a massive weather system that spawned altogether.
Confirming four.
Yeah. That makes it even more like, holy crap, what happened?
This is very, very unusual.
Climate change?
I don't know.
Can't point one storm system, but you can see a trend. And Jay, just so that you know, since we've been talking, I looked back up the green sky phenomenon, and it seems to be the case that green is significant. It doesn't prove that there's a tornado. It's sort of like, in a really intense storm, a sky may appear green because the thunderstorm clouds are so incredibly deep. So it's basically the same phenomenon as why the sky looks blue on a clear day, because the particles, you know, in the atmosphere are scattered. But when a thunderstorm happens, it's usually happening later in the day. Usually the sun's approaching the horizon. The sky looks kind of reddish. But underneath this massive thundercloud, because there's all this water vapor in the air, we see these blue casts. And apparently when those blue objects are illuminated with red light, they look green to us. Isn't that interesting? So it doesn't mean there's a tornado, but it probably means there's a really deep, really thick thundercloud. And usually, or often, those conditions can spawn tornadoes.
And this is a totally typical tornado otherwise, because it's May. May's the most common month for tornadoes. Mm-hmm. And they occur late afternoon. I think it was between 3 and 9. And this was right at 5:15, I think, is when it hit.
Yep,
something like that.
Yep.
So it was pretty right time of year, right time of day. We had hail.
Yep.
We had the...
Hail so intense. It'll ruin your car. I've had so many cars
so we had every,
out
it was,
from hail.
It was a typical tornado, other than the fact that it hit Connecticut, you know?
Yeah. There was a tornado in Brooklyn a few years ago. Do you guys remember that?
Oh,
yeah.
Brooklyn.
Yeah, I remember hearing that.
It's so weird.
All right. Well, we survived and we're recording.
Yes.
We're relentless.
And we have science. I'm so happy you guys are here. And actually, Evan's not really missing in action. He just took his daughter to a concert.
He took his daughter to a concert. We had to reschedule for Thursday and he already had plans. All right. Kara, give us what's the word.
Yes. Okay. Is the word this week a fun one? Actually, it's kind of not that fun. It's kind of weird. Okay. It was a good one that was recommended by Adam from Australia. He came across this word in a Gizmodo article about a family tree of 13 million people who are related across 11 generations. There was a study on this published in the journal Science. A ton. I mean, this is a big data study where they were able to connect 11 generations of people, 13 million people. Holy crap. But anyway, a word that he saw in it was consanguine. This is so hard to say. Let me try that again. Consanguineous.
Consanguineous.
Thank you. Jay, are you feeling proud right now?
I love it.
I thought it was consanguineous.
No, it's consanguineous.
It's consanguineous.
That's how you say it.
I don't like it. I don't like that pronunciation.
Or consanguinity. Either one. So the noun is consanguinity. Consanguineous would be the, I guess that's an adjective, right? Consanguineous relationship. Yeah. Okay. So you don't like it, Bob?
No. I mean, you know, typical when you have a pronunciation in your head for years and you find out you've been wrong. It's annoying, but it's also sometimes it's just not mellifluous, you know, it just doesn't seem to flow like you think it should.
I mean, I think it's perfectly cromulent, but I will be honest. I never saw this word before. It was recommended to me from Adam. So here we go. Consanguinity refers to people who are related by blood. That is, they're genetically related. You know, we use that term blood relative a lot, but and it comes from a time when we didn't really understand genes. But it's, again, that's relating to people who are descended from a common ancestor, a similar ancestor. So there are degrees of consanguinity as per special tables. You can look them up, consanguinity tables, that show the difference between like a first cousin, a second cousin twice removed, thrice removed, etc. It gets kind of complicated. Consanguinity is a term that's commonly used in the legal system, as in most Western countries, as we know, marriage or even sex between first cousins or closer relatives is usually against the law. This is because, again, this shouldn't be new to anybody, but everyone carries a certain load of recessive alleles. If you breed and you create offspring with someone who you are closely related to, they are more likely to carry similar gene variants, which means that, you know, you could end up with offspring that have birth defects, other genetic diseases, or become carriers of those things. Think hemophilia in royal families. That's usually the common example. But because this practice is really common in many parts of the world, a lot of physicians are getting training that they call consanguinity counseling, so that, you know, if these families might immigrate to the U.S. or, you know, even in these different areas of the world, they can be helpful to teach the families about the risks. I found this interesting article in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, in 2010 that said, quote, couples related as second cousins or closer and their progeny account for an estimated 10.4% of the global population. The highest rates consanguineous marriage occur in North and Sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, and West Central and South Asia. In these regions, even couples who regard themselves as unrelated may exhibit high levels of homozygosity because marriage within clan, tribe, or caste has been a long-established religion. But one thing I also noted, I read a lot of different pages to try and get a good understanding of this term. It's important to note that the term incest is defined differently than consanguinity in biological and legal settings. So incest usually refers to relationships between first-degree relatives, like parent-child, sibling-sibling, sometimes grandparent-grandchild, or even uncle-niece. But usually those legal definitions are different than what we're talking about as consanguinity, which is any kind of level of relationship, and you have higher consanguinity if you are more closely related, lower if you are more distantly related. Of course, at a certain point, we're all distantly related, right? So it's all shades of gray to see how close we are. So if you look at the etymology of the term, it's really interesting. It's got Latin roots, as it sounds, and it comes from, if we break up the word, the first part, con, comes from the prefix cum, which means like together. We see that obviously in a lot of words. And sanguineous, what does that sound like to you guys?
Blood.
Blood, yeah. So it's the like coming together of blood, which makes sense, right? Because that's how we used to relate to. We didn't use genes. We talked about blood relatives.
Well, that said, from what I've come across and read and talking with Steve, I think marrying a first cousin really, I mean, ultimately, it's not that risky in terms of.
Not that risky, yeah.
No, it's not that risky, and like it doesn't happen all that much anymore. But I mean, at least not. At least not in the West. But like we said, I know even you sounded surprised, Steve. I was really surprised when I came across that. 10.4% of the global population is second cousins or closer.
All right. Thanks, Kara. So,
yep.
Bob, we got another blue, black, or gold dress situation, but this time with words. This is the Yanny Laurel debate.
Laurel and Yanny. This one's been tearing up the internet. For this whole week, we definitely had to talk about it. Basically, what this is referring to is a short sound file that's being passed around that some people distinctly hear Yanny and other people distinctly hear Laurel. There's no real ambiguity in terms of what you're hearing, and it's fascinating to see people's reactions
to this thing. Kara?
Oh, yeah. I just chatted you guys an image. It has turned into the visual space.
What do you
That's
hear,
That's awesome.
Kara?
So let's play it.
I hear, hands down, I'm Team Laurel all the way. Yanny, I thought it was because I was old, but then I asked a friend of mine who's like almost 10 years younger, and she can only hear Laurel too. Like, I cannot hear Yanny unless I, you know, read those articles where they've digitally removed a portion of the sound wave to make me hear Yanny. But then when they put the whole thing together and I listen to the original file again, it's Laurel. Like, there is no Yanny. I'm Team Laurel all the way. I was also Team White and Gold, just so
I
you know.
I only hear Yanny.
Can I hear
yep,
it?
Yep, me too.
What?
Play it. Let's
so
play
So weird.
Yanny. Yanny. Yanny.
Yanny.
What do you
Yanny.
Hear? Yeah. I think that's interesting that the three of us all hear.
I mean, it's Yanny.
There's no question. Well, actually, I'm hearing more of a Y-A-M-M-Y, right? Yammy? I'm hearing
Yeah,
really
that's
yammy
another. I've read some articles yanny. Of people saying if you hear Yammy, it's actually probably more correct. But yep. because these researchers went in and they couldn't find the N phoneme in there at all. But still, I don't hear it at all. It's Laurel. You guys are monsters. You're so wrong.
So, Bob, what's going on neurologically here? Like, how can – is this pre-programming?
What, do I sound like a neurologist to you? So let me
– If only we had a neurologist.
So this is clearly reminiscent of the dress hubbub from 2015 where some people saw gold and white and other people saw black and blue. And I just loved how vociferous everybody was. They were just like – you, like they were being lied to or they just could not wrap their head around the possibility – that your visual perception is that constructive, right? I mean, just like it can't be. And this is, so I'm seeing similar reactions that it's really funny when people really take it personally almost. It's like, come on, this is science, people. Let's talk about how it was created. So this is actually, and you're probably going to like this, Kara. This is from vocabulary.com. Some high school students were on that website and they took the Laurel pronunciation file from vocabulary.com. And for some reason, they played it and then they recorded it. And then they posted it on Reddit, on Instagram, and then it just went caught like wildfire.
So it started as Laurel?
It was Laurel. But the thing is, and I know it's going to make Team Laurel very happy, but it's really kind of, irrelevant in a way, because when they recorded it, they recorded it off their speakers. And if you look at the actual sound file, the actual spectrogram, you could really see what's going on here. So what happened was when they recorded it playing off their computer, they took a file that had mostly lower frequencies, Laurel. They took that file and it was a clean file. And what the act of recording it off of their computer actually added some noise to the spectrograph, and it also added some high frequencies. So what you had when it was done was an amalgam. You turned it into this kind of amalgamated word that had characteristics of both Laurel and Yanny at the same time.
Yeah, so it's got to be an ambiguous stimuli.
Right. So it's right.
But it's not, because I can't hear Yanny at all.
I think I can make you hear it after a short.
I can hear it when you remove part of the file. Right.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's an app floating around where you could actually, there's a slider where you could accentuate or de-accentuate the frequencies. And at some point you cross a threshold where
I can hear it. But then if I put it back together and it's a source file, it's like, I can't hear it anymore.
You can't hear what anymore?
Yanny, it just completely it's like with the white and the gold. Like I saw the pictures that showed the dress as black and blue, and I'm like, yeah, okay, I see that picture. But then when I see the original picture again, I'm like, no, it's still white and gold. Like I can't get my visual system to switch.
No, you can't.
The same way
it.
I can't get my ears to switch.
Subconscious. Is it your brain hears word-like sounds and it tries to match it to phonemes that it knows. And it makes the best match it can, and then that's what you hear.
Mm-hmm. And so, through priming, can switch back and forth.
Yeah, priming will affect it. That's like if you have like the German song, and then you have the words underneath it about what you're supposed to be hearing. Men like cheese, one.
Yeah.
So you hear what the words are saying because you're being primed, and your brain makes that match. So here you have an ambiguous audio stimuli. It's like it's an auditory illusion. And then if some people are just on one side and the other people are just slightly on the other side, and then your brain makes it completely match whatever the closest thing.
And there's so many cases of this, but I think the dress and the Yanny Laurel thing, for whatever reason, people feel so much more strongly about it because there's a certain group of people, and I think I'm one of them, where no matter what I do, I can't get my brain to look at it the other way.
Yeah, it's more striking, to see that dark dress, and people are saying it's white and gold. It's striking. It's striking. But there's actually a lot of reasons that can contribute to this phenomenon with this Laurel and Yanny thing. So one of them, there's external reasons that can contribute to a certain extent. Like one is device dependent. So it depends on how you're listening to it, from your phone, off of your computer speaker, and your earbuds. Some devices naturally will bias towards a higher frequency or a lower frequency. So that could push you over the edge. Another thing that could affect it externally is your actual ear itself. Somebody referred to it as an ear print. I'm not sure if that's even a real term, but the shape of your ear can actually accentuate some frequencies and not others. That could push you over the edge as well, one way or the other. But then there's the internal reasons. Another one that's maybe it's minor, but it's still there is expectation. If you read, hey, do you hear Yanny when you hear this noise? And then you play it. You are more likely, I think, by a certain amount to hear Yanny. So that expectation could have another effect that pushes you over the edge. But the biggest reason, as Steve was talking about, is this natural bias. Some people will skew towards favoring these higher frequency tones, these sounds, and that will push them over the edge to hear Yanny. And other people will be the opposite, and that push them towards Laurel. So there's really, it's like a kind of like genetic and psychological. I mean, there's really no reason beyond that.
People, I think, some have a hard time understanding how constructed their experience of things is. So they think, oh, you can't be hearing Laurel, because I hear Yanny.
Yes, the good no, all good skeptics know that
that's the way the brain
works.
How
constructed your reality is.
Yeah, this is just
how many times have we said it? Your eyes are not cameras. Your mind is not, you know, you're a computer memory. It's just like your brain conveniently creates this for you, makes a wonderful narrative for you that makes sense, and it constructs a lot of it. So much so that it could cause wacky stuff happening like this. And this just brings it out into the fore. This just slaps you in the face with it.
Yeah.
And that's why people, you know, good skeptics should not behave this way, because we've been over this over and over and over.
All right, let's move on. So, you guys heard about Google Duplex?
Yes.
No. Yes.
Very cool. So, this is Google's new AI that tries to accurately mimic a human in a conversation. So,
and it's awesome.
It's a chatbot. It's a chatbot with a very specific task that it's been trained to do, like make a restaurant reservation. Or right, make a reservation at a hair place or a restaurant, whatever. So it can't talk about, you can't start talking to it about the meaning of life, right? It's got a very
it's got domains, you know.
It's got domains.
Expert systems.
Yeah.
We've talked about this. It's a collection of expert systems.
Yeah.
Right. So it could do, you know, you want it to be able to do a appointment change as an example. It knows how to do that.
Right. So, and they used neural network type of structure to train it on actual human conversations, and so it learned how to mimic the structure of a human.
And you guys heard him? Jay, Kara?
No.
Oh, my God.
Oh, Kara, you haven't heard it?
Totally.
No.
You know,
here we go. Let's see. Let's listen to this one. See if you can hear this.
So, how can I help you?
Hi. I'm calling to book a women's haircut for a client. I'm looking for something on May 3rd.
Sure. Give me 1 second.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. What time are you looking for around?
At 12 p.m.
We do not have a 12 p.m. available. The closest we have to that is a 1:15.
Do you have anything between 10 a.m. and 12 p.m.?
Depending on what service she would like. What service is she looking for?
Just a woman's haircut for now.
Okay. We have a 10 o'clock.
10 a.m. is fine.
Okay. What's her first name?
The first name is Lisa.
Okay, perfect. So I will see Lisa at 10 o'clock on May 3rd.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Great. Have a great day. Bye.
Yeah, I can't tell which one is the chat.
The one that's calling to make the appointment, not the person.
Wow, the one that's calling is the chatbot? She sounds more real. The girl on the other end of the phone sounds fake because she has like these weird delays. You know, she's like, hang on 1 second.
That's hilarious. That's hilarious.
Okay. Yeah. I thought that, wow, that's really good. And so are these pre-recorded words that are strung together using an AI algorithm or are the phonemes actually being pushed together?
They've got to be constructed because you never know what you're going to get back, right? They have to be done on the fly in real time, most of it.
This is a new world, man. This is AI, neural networks,
AI,
this is big
baby.
Data. This is really good.
It's awesome.
So they definitely crossed the line here. So listening to them myself, I could tell that it was a bot, but it was very subtle. And it was only because of the chatbots will often give strangely generic answers to specific responses. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
One point I could tell, the guy said, the kind of thing you could say to almost, in response to almost anything.
Right.
Yeah. So I was like, that was a little chat body, you know, that kind of response.
Right.
But if I didn't know that it was a bot, I may not have picked up on it.
That's the key. If you didn't know, I mean, it's fun. You know, you kind of feel proud, when you get called by a robot and you instantly, within a nanosecond, are you trying to fool me here? Do not waste blah, blah. You hang up on them.
I could
spot those all the time.
Of course, but that's nothing compared to this. I mean, those well-timed pauses that they do and all that, they're betting on the average response and all. I've been fooled by those a little bit, especially in the beginning, but then you do, like Bob says, you pick it up.
Yeah.
But this
I've been fooled by the actual chatbots, like the ones that are text-based on a website where I need tech support or something. I can't tell you how many times I've been like, are you a robot? And I know that they program in a good response for that.
Yeah, so here, this is about throwing in ums and pauses, false starts, correcting yourself mid-sentence, things that people do, real people do. And it's all the errors, you know, that make it sound real. Now, the idea was Google, you know, showed this at a conference and and everyone was impressed. And the idea is that people will feel more comfortable relating to a robot if it's mimicking natural human speech, because, you know, it'll be more of a natural experience. But then immediately there was backlash, and people were saying,
really?
Yeah, they were saying, this is unethical. You're fooling people into thinking they're talking to a real person when they're talking to a bot. This is deception. I mean, really harsh criticism. And so Google had to, like, the next day immediately walk it back and say, we will always disclose that you're talking to a robot before at the beginning of the conversation. Which, to me, it's like, well, doesn't that defeat the purpose? Because then,
if
this person said, this is Google Duplex, you're speaking to a bot, and then they did it, you'd be like, why am I talking to this robot like they're a real person, you know?
Right.
So the question is, why would people, or why should people be upset? And there's any legitimacy to that?
Oh, I got to think about that.
Well, okay. I think the problem is there is something about, like, your guard being down.
Yeah.
You know, there is something about the human interaction that we're all used to. And we just always assume that people are there. They're conscious. They're alive. They're living and breathing. It's all built into the way we interact as human beings.
Yeah.
So I get it. I totally get why people are complaining about this, because it is a emotional deception.
Right.
Also, it's different if you're calling them than if they're calling you. You kind of expect that when you call tech support, it's always going to be a robot.
But I agree, Jade. I think that you're investing some emotional capital in that conversation, even if it's a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, for example, that person may be taking up some of your time and you're being courteous to them.
Yeah.
You would never be courteous to a computer algorithm. And so then you feel like you tricked me into acting like a human of my life.
Well, yeah, because you change. You know, I guess after thinking about this, like, I was really trying to figure out what would my take be on it. Because at first I'm kind of like the whole, like, oh my God, this is great. It's cool.
Yeah.
You know, but then
it is cool. The technology is cool.
But I really don't like the deception part of it, because I think a lot of times in my life when I'm talking to people under these circumstances, I get a little personal.
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell people, oh, yeah, are you anywhere near Connecticut? Did you hear about the tornado? You know, I'll just chit chat a little bit just to, you know, I mean, because that's like, it's important, I think, just to have a human touch to it. If their AI, and it's right around the corner, if it doesn't have it now, it will be able to chit chat.
Yeah.
And then what am I, you know, I could.
But isn't that the point, Jay? Like, when you look at all of this research into using humanoid robots on, like, assembly lines, like getting away from the big manufacturing bots and having them express human emotions or having them react so that they can't harm you, isn't the whole point that eventually we're going to live in a world where we interact with robots as if they're people? And we should be using real human emotions with them.
Well, Carrie, yeah, I totally agree. What we're experiencing right now is, it's the change. You know, it's like that first time you picked up a cell phone and all of a sudden you're like, whoa, you know, we're going to see, like, personal assistants. And, you know, at one day, I know in my lifespan, at some point in time, Bob and Steve's and your personal assistants will call me.
Yeah.
Just like this.
And how about this, Jay? Not only that. Our personal assistant will call your personal assistant. We're going to have these chatbots talking to each other.
Yeah.
It'll be people on both ends of the conversation.
And then the really screwed up thing is then we're going to find out that they're having more fun than we are.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, shit's going to fall down.
Well, how about this angle? I mean, speaking as we do is an efficient means of communication for us. And this is communicating in a way that might be much more efficient than previously. What about that angle? I understand the emotional investment. Maybe they could just don't put all those ums and ahs in there. Even without those little human ticks in the conversation, it's still a beautifully done. It's still, you know, the pauses, the intonation, everything that it did, even without any ummer or it still would be a huge difference.
You know what's funny, though, when you mentioned that, it reminded me of the fact that if you think about it, this instantly made all science fiction kind of obsolete, because one of the hallmarks of androids and robots or whatever is that they speak a little unnaturally. And that's just part of their affectation. And
like on Star Trek.
Yeah, even 100 years from now or 200 years from now, robots of those time speak unnaturally, but we've already cracked that. They can speak completely.
But I like that. I was saying, where was this? I want my assistant to talk like that. I think that would be fun.
So then you would, that would be a choice.
Right, that's a cultural, that's a cultural choice.
You want it to speak like a robot so you know it's a robot.
Right, right.
Well, no, I mean, part of it is just the fun of it. Like, I want it to sound like working.
Yeah.
You know, like an answer.
but that novelty wears off very quickly.
Yeah.
Right, so that's also a very temporary thing.
I agree. I think we'll be scrolling through famous people's voices and stuff at some point. You know, I want my robot to sound like
Humphrey
Samuel
Bogart.
Bogart.
Oh my gosh. And you know what's so funny is that I think to some extent people are already sort of doing that. A really good friend of mine, a male friend of hers who's kind of funny and techy and nerdy, convinced her to hand her phone over for a few minutes one day, which is never, you should just never do that because your outgoing image is going to, something is going to change on your phone. And she could not for the life of her figure out what he did until the next time she was in her car and she played Google Maps and all the instructions were him.
Oh, wow. Nice.
And it was so funny. He'd be like, yeah, turn left here now. You know, it's like, you can do it. There's some sort of app that lets you do it where you don't say any of the street names, obviously, but you say like turn left, turn right, stop, you know,
yeah,
and
it's and nerd funny. Stuff, yeah.
And she hasn't gotten rid of it because it makes her laugh still, but yeah, we're already doing that.
Oh, I gotta do that. Jay, you could do that in a Jerky Boys voice.
Oh, God, yeah, I know. It's gonna be a lot of fun when all that starts to hit. You know, and talking
they're
about
that now, they're doing that now.
But the personal assistant thing to me, once that really happens, now, I'm not talking Siri or you know, even you know, you have Alexa or whatever.
Alexa.
Whatever. Yeah. You know, they're fine. I have Alexa. It's fun and all that. But it's dumb.
All right, Jay. SpaceX has broken through another barrier.
SpaceX is my dream company because it's making promises and they're actually achieving their promises. So this is a big one, guys. What I'm about to tell you. This is a big one. So one of the most important SpaceX missions has recently happened, and we didn't even know it. I know.
What are you talking about?
First off, you hear like, there's another SpaceX launch.
My hopes are pretty high here.
It goes into the background now, right? We're not even like watching the launches that much anymore. I mean, I try to watch all of them if I can, but I miss a lot of them. And now, you know, we find out a recent launch had something remarkable about it. Well, what was so cool about it? They launched a Falcon 9 vehicle that was outfitted with all of SpaceX's reusability technology. They finally got all of it to the level that they want, all right? So it's named the Block 5.
Block 5?
Yeah, it's a version of the Falcon. And this rocket is designed so it can safely launch and land at least 10 times without maintenance or refurbishing.
Oh, whoa. Yep. 10?
That's... Oh, yeah. Is this the one they want to return, like have an hour or 24-hour turnaround time?
Yeah, they wanted to do two launches of the same rocket in one day. I think that's the ultimate goal.
Oh.
That is insanity.
But immediately it's going to go from months to weeks, and it's more of just scheduling and getting it back around and, you know, the refueling
logistics
and all that.
And stuff.
But listen to the details. There's a lot of great stuff here.
Whoa.
So first off, this is a huge game changer for space vehicles. This is huge. The best level of reusability that has ever been achieved was by SpaceX, and they only were able to do two missions with some degree of repair in between. And this is all them getting the build up to get to where they are now. So Elon said, in a quote, "It's taken us 16 years of extreme effort, many iterations, and thousands of small but important development changes to get to where we think this is even possible. Crazy hard." They've put in billions of dollars into this to get to where the technology is today. So SpaceX says that...
Did Elon say crazy hard, or was
that
yours?
No, he did. That was him. That wasn't me.
Oh, cool.
SpaceX says the vehicle is over-engineered in a good way, meaning that it meets and outperforms the safety standards so humans can be aboard. So this isn't like a risky rocket at all. They said, we're going to build a reusable rocket that's going to hit human occupancy standards, which is magnificent. The first astronaut is supposed to fly on the first mission on this vehicle when? Take a guess.
2020.
Tomorrow.
Wow, that's Tara? Soon. 2022.
This year.
What?
Legitimately.
Who's the astronaut? Have they picked him yet?
They didn't name the astronaut yet.
This was the milestone for that.
Yes. So the thing I love about SpaceX is they don't do that in 5 years business. Like, it's happening now. It's always happening now. I love that about them. So the Block 5's lower segment of the Falcon is being inspected. This is the one that just landed. And the engineers have the expectation that they will find minimal wear and no refurbishing should be necessary. So it's refuel and put it back on the path to getting back into a launch cycle. So this level of technology, guys, is the change in the industry that is truly going to change spaceflight with humanity. These flights now are going to start to cost a lot less because 60% of the cost is in the booster rockets. which they just get thrown away. I mean, most of the craft material historically, all of it gets thrown away. You know, what do they reuse? You know, reusability in space flight didn't exist. So they're going to save 60% of the money to do these launches. And that's where we're at now within this year or 2 years. We're going to be there.
Do they give you a price per pound, what it could drop to? Because right now, I think the classic number that I've heard for way too long is like $10,000 per pound.
Well, drop it by 60%.
So put that
4,000.
I mean, if SpaceX then you got to factor in after 10. They're going to make more money though. Like they're not going to pass on all the savings, but a lot of it, I'm sure. So they were saying the way that it's going to work is it's going to be a launch, a landing, a refueling, and a relaunch. No, nothing. No maintenance. Just they inspect it. Everything's good. They send it back up. No maintenance. After 10 flights, it goes through a moderate maintenance. And then their expectation is it can do 100 missions until they have to retire it. That means that it's going to fly 100 times and they're going to have to do something 10 times during that 100 times. Every 10th flight, they'll do some level of maintenance to fix the things that wear out.
That's pretty darn good. I mean, it's not at like 747 level.
No,
but it's getting there.
For outer space.
Close, yeah.
So Elon was saying that he wants to have 30 of the Block 5s in rotation. So they'll constantly have a rocket ready to go up.
Yeah.
And this is another thing that we need, because why do we want a company to have a rocket always ready to go up?
Well, if you have a colony on the moon or on Mars.
Exactly. Or if there's an emergency or we have to do something with an asteroid, whatever. Like we need instantaneous ability to get into space and do stuff. And I just think it's brilliant. So this is the game changer. I love it.
Damn, like, how do we not know this?
5, 10 years, it's here. I know.
Wow. I wonder what their next milestone is. What's their next big milestone?
Crude person.
Right? Yeah. I mean, their capsule years ago, right? I mean, their crew capsule is amazing.
The Dragon.
The Dragon. It's amazing. It's gorgeous, it looks, you know, Elon is, you know, having them design it to look like it's in a sci-fi movie, which is awesome.
Oh my God. I just love him.
Yeah.
I mean, what's their next big hardware milestone? Because this rocket right now is pretty much ready for manned missions. So they're already there.
Even if it just iterates
crude,
at this point.
Crude missions.
Right, right.
Missions is the next big thing, and then it's just iterations, you know, which is good.
And aren't they 3D printing a lot of the components for these rockets?
Yeah.
I mean, this
3D you know, if you think about the, you know, the concentric circles of technology coming together, like 3D printing is so usable today. It's such a powerful way to create components. And also, you know, we think about 3D printing and they have a 3D printer on the International Space Station as an example. They need a tool. They need, you know, the engineers on Earth can design something and send them up the thing to print it. That'll fix the problem that they have that they could never, the astronauts could never
have concocted.
So you have a support staff down here in manufacturing up in outer space.
Yeah. Like with Apollo 13, it's like, this is what you have to work with.
Yeah.
You know, the stuff that's on the table. You can't make anything that's not already there.
And that was my favorite part of the movie.
Yeah.
They had that huge room of engineers, and like, this is what the guys have up there.
It's the competency.
Figure out. Yeah. God, I love that.
So did you guys hear that California now considers coffee to be a carcinogen?
Ugh, California considers everything to be a carcinogen.
I know. It's crazy.
Well, wait. Is there any truth to this, or is there anything bad about it? I mean, roasting, you know.
What level of carcinogenicity?
It's all the same to California. That's the problem. They put a plaque on everything.
It's based on the fact that there's a little bit of acrylamide in coffee.
What's that?
Acrylamide is according to the IARC, it's a probable carcinogen. So here's the thing. Kara's right. You know, if you set the threshold too low for warning people about things like this may be a carcinogen, this may cause cancer, they begin to ignore all of your warnings because they're not really giving them any useful information. It's called
alarm fatigue. Well, and they don't even say may, Steve. The warnings in California say this contains a chemical known to the state of California to cause cancer.
I know. They don't really make the distinction. So here's the thing. So for things that might – we talked about hazard and risk just last week. Mm-hmm. You can't give people a substance and see if it causes cancer, right? That's unethical. So there's no like double-blind placebo-controlled trials looking at the cancer-causing, you know, effects of – drinking coffee. It doesn't exist. So what they do is they do basic science studies. You know, you expose cells to it in a petri dish and animal studies. But that really only tells you about hazard, right? The potential of the substance to cause cancer-like changes or whatever.
Yeah.
That's like, again, the shark in the tank is a hazard. but it doesn't tell you what the risk is of the real life exposure to coffee. Like when the person in this demographic group drinks this much coffee for this much time, their risk goes up by how much? You know, that's risk.
Oh, yeah.
We don't have that information.
The only other alternative is just to do like epidemiological, but that only gives you correlational information.
Exactly. You do observational studies, which is correlational. Now, you can get to the point where correlational data is so robust that you could say, okay, mm-hmm. this is a carcinogen, like smoking and lung cancer. We know that there's a dose response curve, the type of smoking that you do, the duration, and it increases the specific risk of an otherwise rare lung cancer, you know? So,
and we've ruled out all of the potential confounds there. Like, we know it's the actual...
It's only observational, but it's a home run.
Yeah.
That level of data doesn't exist for coffee. It's based just on the hazard, just on the preclinical data for acrylamide. And so the IARC says, well, there's no clinical data showing that this is a cancer risk, but because it's a cancer hazard in the petri dish and in animals, we're going to say that it's a probable carcinogen. And then California, according to their laws, this Prop 65 law, they go from probable carcinogen to it causes cancer.
Yeah, known to the state of California to cause cancer.
Each step of the way, they erred on the side of increasing the warning. But because it was happening in tandem, you end up with California saying this is known to cause cancer for something that's not known to cause cancer. There's no clinical data showing that coffee causes cancer. It's just based on a probable risk, you know, hazard of one of the components. And so again, that sets the threshold so low, based, I think, inappropriately on the precautionary principle, that you end up causing inadvertent harm, right? I think there's actual real harm from this. First of all, it's the alarm fatigue. So what happens is that, again, you get this sort of alarm fatigue. Nobody's gonna take that warning seriously, which means they're not gonna take any cancer warnings seriously, which means they're now all worthless, right? There was a study in 2013 where they looked at 50 sequential ingredients in a cookbook, and then they looked at the literature to see how many of them had studies which showed they caused cancer. What percentage do you think were linked to cancer?
Less than a percentage.
70%.
Wait, sorry, what percentage of what?
I thought you were saying how many people got cancer.
No. Out of 50 random ingredients in the cookbook, 72% of them had this preclinical study showing
God.
A correlation.
Like what? Like coriander?
Everything.
Stuff like that?
Everything. That's like everything causes cancer.
Yeah, like salt.
Yeah, but wait a second. What about dosage? I mean, dosage
that's,
is a
that,
huge...
that you're talking about risk. You know, now you're talking about. That's the point.
Yeah, So,
according to California level of warning, you know, pretty much, you know, 2/3 or 3/4 of everything out there should be warned against, you know, it's a possible link to cancer. It also, I think, reduces the faith that people have in just experts and expertise, right? Well, the experts say coffee causes cancer, so we could ignore anything the experts say, right? Because they're crazy.
Absolutely.
Totally. Yeah. It totally makes people not trust authority or medical authority anymore at all, which sucks because this is actually just legislative authority.
No, it's just some judge, you know, looking at it and saying, and applying.
It was in this case, right? It was like one judge.
Right.
Ugh.
So it's not giving people information they can use. It's just fear mongering. And the other thing is, and that's just for what it is, but we also live in a world where this kind of fear mongering has been weaponized from marketing and to promote ideological agendas like anti-GMO campaigns, right? So you take this kind of level of stuff, and this is exactly what happened with glyphosate, right? The exact same thing. Mm-hmm. Is then it becomes weaponized for anti-GMO propaganda, or people do it to sell self-help books. Like, oh, you got to detox. So what are they going to use? Coffee enemas to detox from the coffee toxins now so you don't get cancer?
No.
But this is now feeding an industry of fear and the orthorexia, right? The all food's bad for you. You got to reach it. How many people are going to... So people either ignore it or they don't ignore it, in which case you have to have this super restrictive diet because everything's killing you.
You know, it's like every single thing we put in our body is a choice and we have to make these mindful choices. And when you start to, just like you said, you start to feel like nothing is healthy, then all of a sudden you might not take in certain compounds or macromolecules or things that actually could potentially have positive health benefits.
Well, you know, I think a part of it too is like, you know, you just think of the food babe. and her reaction to a piece of news like this. She's always looking for content. Like these people, these bloggers and journalists and stuff are always looking for things to talk about. They have to jump on it. It's like us finding a juicy science news item. You know, we want to talk about it. And that's, I think that's part of the problem is you give them, you know, these news items come up, they use them and they're fear mongering and that's what they want. That's how they keep their engine running is off of fear mongering.
Yeah. Well, whatever. I still drink coffee every morning and I love my coffee.
Nothing could make me stop. Nothing.
I know.
But at least you've been warned. All right, Kara, I understand that octopuses come from outer space.
Yeah, I was about to say two things wrong with that statement. The plural of octopus is octopuses. And not only do they probably not come from, I guess technically I can only say they probably don't, but I feel pretty confident saying they most definitely don't come from outer space. What do you guys think? Do octopuses come from outer space?
What about Cthulhu? I mean, of course they do.
So there's actually a study that was published that is causing, it's like within kind of the SciComm community and some really science-minded people on social media, it's almost as big as Yanny Laurel. Like, this will not die, and it is so frustrating. So there's a study in press right now, or no, actually it is, it was published, looks like March 13th, 2018. In the somewhat obscure journal, Progress in Biophysics and Molecular Biology. It has 33 authors, and it you can access it in full text. You can read the entire interesting, entertaining study. And when I say study, I mean published article, because no study was actually completed, where the scientists got together and literally made some very bizarre claims. Let me do a pull quote from a science communicator on Twitter who said, here's where they jump the octopus in this paper. Quote, "The transformative genes leading from the consensus ancestral nautilus to the common cuttlefish to squid to the common octopus," and I'm leaving out all their Latin names, "are not easily to be found in any pre-existing life form. It is plausible then to suggest they seem to be borrowed from a far distant, quote, future, unquote, in terms of terrestrial evolution, or more realistically, from the cosmos at large."
So they're just making shit up.
Yeah. So this study, which is called, or I got to stop calling it study. This article, which the title is "Cause of Cambrian Explosion: Terrestrial or Cosmic?" question mark, has been published by, once again, 33 scientists from different departments all over the world. We've got people from the University of Melbourne. We've got people from Michigan Technological University, University of Buckingham. We've got, let's see, Sri Lanka, India, Johannesburg, South Africa, Toronto, Canada, lots of places, legitimate institutions all over the world.
What's their actual point? I don't understand.
And you know what? What?
I don't understand what their actual point is.
Their point is that these people are panspermia people.
Oh, of course.
Yes.
Okay, they're cool.
Of course. And so the problem is when they publish this, 33 scientists from legitimate universities all over the world, a lot of news outlets picked it up. And I mean, I can just go through, I fucking love science. Bizarre new study suggests octopuses came from outer space. Tech out, Newsweek, are octopuses from outer space? Study suggests cephalopod eggs traveled to Earth on a comet. Boing boing, scientists declare octopi life from another world. Come on, boing boing.
Wow.
Yeah. Let's see, Cosmos, a great Australian outlet. Viruses, ET, and the octopus from space, the return of panspermia. They never overtly refute it, but at least it's a much more measured, it's much more measured coverage. They mostly just covered the article. And then you've got some that really do editorialize in a way that I think is more consumer friendly. You know, it's in a way that is helpful. So this one is "An Insane Paper Tests the Limits of Science by Claiming Octopuses Came from Outer Space." Don't laugh. It's serious. That's Science Alert. BuzzFeed: "Did octopuses come from aliens? Quote, there is no evidence for it at all." End quote.
I like that.
"The theory cannot be taken seriously," one expert said. So yeah, it's just, it's everywhere. It's all over the internet right now. And you really do have to dig to find, I think, some really good coverage. Like, there's a WordPress blog from an individual who wrote The Pseudoscience of Octopuses from Space, which is great, but it doesn't have far-reaching coverage. Snopes luckily did some coverage. Does octopus DNA come from space? Researchers did not discover that octopus DNA is alien or that it originated anywhere but Earth. This claim is false. And then, of course, I think the study that we'll link to for the show is a Live Science piece covered by Brandon Spector called No, comma, Octopuses Don't Come from Outer Space. That, I think, in my view, is a much more responsible headline.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the only thing that if I had to write a blog post on this, it would be something very similar to that. Anything else is ridiculous. And at some point, you have to make your article title even stronger than maybe you would have normally done it anyway, because so many people are so wrong that you've got to really put a huge exclamation point after what, you know, when you're talking about it, because it's crazy. Now, did I miss it? What was the actual point that they,
what's their argument? That's what I was saying.
Right, evidence?
So their argument is that the complex nervous systems, camera-like eyes, and camouflage capability of the octopus does not have precedent within their family tree, and that it evolved suddenly, and that nothing in terms of terrestrial evolution could account for this. And more plausibly or realistically, these genes were flung to space on a comet with frozen octopus eggs in them.
That's such bullshit.
Wow. I know. It's so bankrupt.
Multiple scientists have written responses to this saying there is nothing within the evolutionary history of the octopus, the evolutionary history of life, that suggests we need alternative explanations for this. The most well-accepted explanation is abiogenesis, this idea that early during the kind of primordial soup era, there were less complex molecules that kind of were able to build and build and build. Eventually, we had amino acids. Eventually, we had more complex proteins. Eventually, we were able to get RNA and then DNA. And there is a course in which life seemed to evolve. These guys that wrote this paper, two of the main authors, are long-standing panspermia advocates. And they have written about this in one form or another over decades. One of the guys is a neo-Lamarckian. The other guy actually doesn't have quite as controversial a track record, but you know he's going to now. So Edward Steele is the guy who has the longer history. He's an immunologist. He is, he actually calls his views meta-Lamarckism. He says that evolution relies on acquiring gene changes that are determined by the influence of the environment rather than random mutations. And then another guy, Chandra Wickramasinghe, less controversial, but did the reason that probably the contributions there are carrying more weight is because he is somewhat famous for empirically confirming the hypothesis put forward by Sir Fred Hoyle that complex carbon molecules do exist on interstellar dust. And so, but just because we have seen evidence of that, we have seen no evidence anywhere across the planet. We have lots of meteorites. I have meteorites in a bowl on my bookshelf. There are people who have, like, there are museums that have meteorite, like, thousands and thousands of meteorites. And we've never, ever, 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 ever found any evidence that there's any organic information. There's no viruses. They claim that viruses have been inserting, cosmic viruses have inserted themselves, these retroviruses, and made diversification of life happen more quickly. They think that the whole Cambrian explosion occurred because these retroviruses inserted themselves into terrestrial genomes and caused really quick mutagenic change. They don't believe that the changes that we saw during the cosmic or the Cambrian quote-unquote explosion could have happened that quickly. But it's all completely made up.
Kara, so it's, are they saying, and this might sound crazy, but you know, I've learned that my craziest mm-hmm. idea is not the craziest idea out there. Are they saying that the octopi flew spaceships here?
No, they're saying that, so there's one of two things that we can look at. It seems that they're most kind of quote-unquote rational claim is that there were retroviruses and other viruses that were in comet debris, and that those comets crashed into Earth and they infected these Earth octopus genomes, causing this explosion of change within the DNA. But what really I think is happening here is that they found an example of really interesting life on planet Earth.
Yeah,
octopuses
right.
are interesting. There are so many great, good, legitimate scientific papers written about them. Ed Yong wrote a great piece in The Atlantic called Octopuses Do Something Really Strange to Their Genes, and it might be connected to their extraordinary intelligence. They can kind of do some reprogramming of their genes on the fly, which is fascinating. They do have these really cool eyes. They have this really cool ability to camouflage. They can contort themselves in really interesting ways.
And they're like, smart as hell. They're called the primates of the sea.
Yeah, but that doesn't make them aliens. Just because we can't fully explain something doesn't mean it has to be an alien. And also, we're pretty good at explaining this.
Yeah, for me, though, the crux is the idea that you could have some sort of extraterrestrial genetic material that is in any way compatible enough with genetic material on the Earth to integrate itself seamlessly. Just that alone
is insanity.
It's ridiculous. And you would need Nobel Prize level evidence.
We have so many examples of material that did crash into the Earth, and we've never, ever, 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 ever found even a remote trace of life on it. Nothing. Like, there's not a single sliver of evidence to support this, like, cockamamie hypothesis.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to see what people would say and what they'd concoct and they'd retrofit and all the things that they do to get to their conclusion that pleases them. What's so jerky about this is that, of course, they pick the octopus because it's interesting, it's cool, it's accessible. There's way crazier stuff going on at the bottom of the ocean than octopus.
Yeah.
Octopus is my opinion.
Oh, and Jay, to kind of answer the question that you asked, they did propose an alternative hypothesis. Sorry, I stopped after talking about the retroviruses. They did propose an alternative hypothesis. There is a hilarious figure. It's figure 5 in the study, guys, or the article. You guys have to look at this. It's got a picture of a cuttlefish and then a plus sign and then a picture of a virus and then an arrow and then a picture of an octopus. Like, that is their figure.
QED.
That makes it all clear.
It's
now.
All it takes.
And the, what do you call it? The caption under says, the evolution from squid to octopus is compatible with a suite of genes inserted by extraterrestrial viruses. An alternative extraterrestrial scenario discussed is that a population of cryopreserved octopus embryos soft landed en masse from space 275 million years ago. Mm-hmm. So not only is there, as I said, more, I can't even, it's like all shades of crazy. but like that one is especially bananas.
Yeah.
It's just, and people are taking it seriously. And because it was published in a peer-reviewed journal, this was peer-reviewed. This is not a pay-for-play journal. Because it was published in a peer-reviewed journal and it's open access, all of these reporters who don't have a lot of training in writing about science did a really irresponsible job covering it. And so then all of these really responsible, skeptical, well-trained science journalists and communicators had to come up and clean up the mess. But as we know, the first time something is talked about, it usually holds more weight than when somebody goes, wait, that's wrong. You're not seeing the full picture.
Yep.
Yeah, it's basically, let's find out who all the crappy science journalists are out there. Oh, okay, here we go.
Yeah, just Google this. And some of them, you know, do what they've been taught to do is they write, this paper says, claims this, and then at the end, we interviewed this one guy, and he says this is all bullshit, so you make up your mind,
maybe,
right?
Exactly.
Which is crap.
Maybe that's the whole point. This is a filter to find all the bad science journalists.
Exactly. And so, but there, it's also a filter to find some really good, really responsible science journalists. And so, hey, people are always asking, they're always writing into the show and saying, you know, what's a foolproof way to know if I'm reading legitimate science? How, you know, what's the litmus test? Is there a checklist? And we're like, unfortunately, it's not that simple. Like, here are some rules of thumb, but, you know, they don't always pass muster. Here is a good litmus test. go out there and look at all, just Google this headline and you'll see hundreds of articles and you'll see some of them have a lot of citations. Read them and then look at who wrote the ones that are legitimate and who wrote the ones that are really irresponsible. That might give you some guidance.
Yeah.
This is a clear-cut example.
All right, let's move on. So, you know, we're trying to cobble together a show here from our bunker. Jay's not going to be able to do Who's That Noisy, so we'll save that for next week. We're actually going to go straight to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake.
Yes.
We have a theme this week.
Tornadoes.
Tornadoes.
All right.
Of course.
Oh, no.
And four items.
Oh, okay.
Because it's tornadoes.
Yeah.
All right, here we go. Item number one. The United States experiences 75% of the world's tornadoes, about 1,000 per year. Item number two. The EF scale used to rate tornado intensity is largely based on direct measurements of wind speeds in the region of the tornado. Item number three, the largest tornado on record lasted for 3.5 hours and traveled over 70 miles per hour. And number four, the single deadliest tornado in world history occurred in Bangladesh in 1989, killing over 1,300 people. I'm going to warn you ahead of time that I am not necessarily strictly sticking to my one order of magnitude rule of thumb because there isn't that much room to play with this. You know
yeah,
what I
got
mean?
You. All right, that's interesting that you gave us that. Okay.
Bob, go first.
All right. U.S. experiences 75% of the world's tornadoes. You know, I'm trying to think of like stories of tornadoes in other countries, and I just don't remember a lot of them. But I do tend to, I think that does ring a bell that maybe it's not 75%, you know, maybe it's 60%, 65%, but that sounds about right. So let's do the next one, the EF scale to rate tornado intensity. I don't remember the name of the scale, but I have a problem with the idea that it's based on direct measurements of wind speed. I think they don't need to directly measure it. Otherwise, you know, I think that's too risky and unnecessarily difficult. Let's see. Let's go to the third one. Largest one, 3.5 hours, 70 miles an hour. Wow. That's amazing. 3.5 hours. That's a lot of tornado time. And 70 miles an hour. Whew. All right. Let's see. Deadliest tornado, 1,300 people. Yeah. I mean, sure. I could buy that. All right. I'm just going to go with my gut on this and just say that we don't need direct measurements to determine the tornado intensity. You could infer it, I think, pretty reliably in lots of different ways other than direct measurements. So number two, direct measurements is fiction.
Okay, Jay.
The fourth one, the deadliest tornado in the world, in world history, occurred in Bangladesh. I think that's science, killing 1,300 people. I could see that densely populated area, and maybe the people, unfortunately, didn't have any place to go protect themselves. But I'm having a problem with all these other ones here. So going to item number three, the largest tornado on record lasted for 3.5 hours. When you say the largest, it's the size. And then you're saying it lasted 3.5 hours. Now, I'm going to ask for a point of clarification. 3.5 hours in contact with the ground or 3.5 hours of the storm?
No, the tornado itself.
Lasted.
It's only a tornado when it's touching the ground.
Really? It's not, even if it's like 3/4
of the
way.
It's not a tornado until it hits the ground.
Oh, my God. I mean, 3.5 hours. Everything that...
Yeah.
All of the data I have in my head about tornadoes, there's no way they last 3.5 hours. How could that possibly be science? Moving on to the EF scale, I don't know, Bob. I mean, we have wind measurement machines all over the place now. Direct measurement, I mean, why wouldn't we be able to directly measure? Can we see wind speed on Doppler radar? I'm pretty sure we can. That's a direct measurement.
Really? Well, I was thinking more of like physical instrumentation on site.
Well, I don't think Steve would clarify that point because I think that's the trick on this one. But I think Doppler radar is a direct measurement. And that's how we know when we're seeing, you know, certain type of warning signs about certain types of weather behavior. That's how we know it. So I don't know. I could be wrong about
that,
but I'm
pretty
sure.
Depends how you define it. Yep. Depends how you define it.
Pretty sure. So I think that one is science. And then going to the first one here, I mean, 75% of the world's tornadoes happening just in the United States. when you think about the size of the United States compared to the rest of the world, and you know what makes, why would the United States? Well, we do have a lot of trailer parks, and those are tornado magnets. That's a god. That's a good one, Steve. Damn, that seems like too much to me, though. Yep. So it's between number one and number three. I don't know, man. And he's notice, Kara, he didn't put the one in here about it turning green when the tornadoes come.
Yeah. Well, he would have made us shut up if we were talking about that.
All right. I do not think that the largest tornado on record also happened to be the one that lasted the longest for 3.5 hours. That would be a 3.5 hour path at 70 miles an hour. It would have covered so much territory. No, that one's the fiction.
Okay, Kara?
I think I'm either going to go with Bob or go with Jay on this. I think that the first clue, the United States experiences 75% of the world tornadoes, about 1,000 per year. That might be off by a little bit, so maybe this is the one you get us on. But yes, the vast majority of tornadoes occur in the U.S., and there are a lot. Like, I don't know if it's 1,000 or 1,500 or 500, so maybe you're getting me on this. But I don't know. This one seems totally realistic to me. Same with the Bangladeshi tornado. Unfortunately, just, you know, when you have more damage and more death when you have homes that don't have foundations, when you have really densely populated areas. I think that's where the trailer park joke often comes in the U.S. is that, like, oh, all the, you know, tornadoes love to attack trailer parks. It's no, they just cause a lot more damage in trailer parks because they don't have foundations generally. So I'm going to say that those two are science, and I'm really torn between the EF scale and the largest tornado on record, again, because of the wording. So, Bob, if I'm remembering correctly, it's the Fujita or like Fujito scale. And I think the E is like the enhanced or the newer Fujita scale. And it is based on wind speeds. But that direct measurement word is what's getting me too. I mean, we all saw Twister. They don't fly into the middle of a tornado every single time there's a tornado and take active measurements. So unless the tornado happens to pass right over some sort of Doppler measurement, they're going to have to estimate it based on, like, you know, measurements that were taken nearby, based on damage, things like that. I just don't think that there are direct measurements. But at the same time, I agree with Jay that 3.5 hours traveling over 70 miles per hour, I mean, it might have turned back on itself a lot and kind of hovered and stayed in, you know, certain neighborhoods, and maybe that, you know, prevented it from wreaking as much havoc. But if it is the largest, we're probably talking miles in diameter. Very rare for a tornado to last that long. Usually they touch down, do their thing, dance around, and then they're out. So
some of them even have multiple
tornadoes inside
vortices within. So if you look at damage, it's like, wait, what was happening there? That makes no sense because it's multiple vortices.
I know. And they're super erratic. Like, that's the thing about tornadoes. That's what makes them so scary to so many people, is you can't really predict if they're gonna zig left, zig right. So this one's really bugging me. But you know what? I think that it's really a function of how important is the word direct measurement and how important is the word largest. Maybe there's another way to define largest, like it had the largest path of damage. I don't know. But direct measurement is a very strong statement. So I'm going to go ahead and go with Bob on this and say it's actually based on indirect measurements, because I'm sure some of them have been directly measured, but that must be really rare.
Okay, so you all agree on 1 and 4, so we'll read those. So we'll start with number one. The United States experiences 75% of the world's tornadoes, about 1,000 per year. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
All right. Yeah, baby.
America, all right. Baby. Yeah, so we have
why? What's going on with that?
3/4 of the world of the tornadoes that happen in the world happen in America, about 1,000 per year. It's just the climate, you know, the weather patterns that we have here. We have big open plains.
We're unique in a lot of ways in terms of, like, tornado our alley, biome maybe. And stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, Tornado Alley, that's where most of them occur. Not very many in Connecticut, but that that does add to the total. So, yeah, that one is science. The single deadliest tornado, however, in the world history occurred in Bangladesh in 1989, killing over 1,300 people. You guys all also think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yep. Yeah.
No sweep.
I remember that.
1989. Yeah. And it's right. Yeah. Of course, like all the deadliest, whatever, like hurricane, this and that, they usually do occur in like Bangladesh, you know, or that part of the world. Because as you say, Kara, they don't have basements to go into. They don't have the infrastructure for it. So it does a lot more damage. But that's, imagine 1,300 people dying in one brief event.
Yeah. After what we saw though, Steve, I mean, you could understand.
Oh, absolutely. And we experienced the smallest possible tornado, you know, and look how much damage it did. All right. Let's go back to number three. The largest tornado on record lasted for 3.5 hours and traveled at over 70 miles per hour. If that were true, and it didn't just hover, that means it would have left a path of destruction something like 286 miles long or something like that, which is exactly what happened because this one is science.
Whoa!
That's my nightmare. That is a nightmare.
That is your nightmare right
there. Wait, are we talking F5?
Oh, absolutely. This is an F5.
Yeah. What?
Where'd it happen?
It happened in America.
And how many people got killed?
Well, an F5 for 3.5 hours?
That's so scary. Oh my gosh. That is like the movie Twister, like the nightmare's not ending.
You'd figure that whatever energy, you know, fuels a tornado would be discharged way before 3.5 hours.
Yeah, so it was an F5.
So this was before it was called an EF.
That's insane.
And the fastest, 73 miles per hour, covering 219 miles. Wow. Longest path, 219 miles. Longest path, longest duration.
It's probably important to differentiate that that would have been the speed of its actual movement, not its wind speed.
Yeah, yeah, that's the speed of its movement. Its wind speed was probably something around 200 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And the 695 fatalities, 695.
Whoa.
When did it happen?
This was in 1925.
Okay.
Cut across Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana.
Wow, it wasn't even Oklahoma.
No.
What a monster.
I wonder what its path was. I'd like to see like how it jigged and jagged, you know?
Yeah, that was a monster. And all of this means that an EF, the EF scale used to rate tornado intensity is largely based on direct measurements of wind speeds in the region of the tornado. That one is the fiction. Bob and Kara, you are correct. It is entirely based on indirect measurements. That we actually don't have machines that can survive, that can withstand the speed of a tornado.
So Doppler radar can't
no, so it,
no, you have to make them out of little aluminum cans. Remember, come on, haven't we all seen Twister?
No, so it's based on the damage done. They say this is how fast the wind would have to go in order to cause this kind of damage. Yeah. And so if you see this kind of damage, then this is how fast the winds were going.
So it's all physics, baby.
So yeah, that's it. And it is the enhanced Fujita scale. It is Fujita scale. Is when they updated it, because they actually downgraded the speeds because they thought like it would take higher winds to lift a house off its foundation. And they realized, no, actually you could do it with slower winds. Mm-hmm. So they just downgraded the speeds a little bit. So that's now the EF scale. So EF1 is what they rated the tornado in Connecticut. But see, I don't know about that because EF1 is supposed to be, moderate damage. And then EF2 says, the damage can cause trees to uproot or break in half.
Well, we're seeing that.
But we've seen that. Yeah. See, the damage that I saw looks to me like an F2, just what they're describing as F2. Mm-hmm. But they said it was F1. But they also said 110 miles per hour, which is right at the border between F1 and F2.
Yeah. You did you see any uprooted trees?
Oh,
or
yeah. Jay saw it right on my street.
I have one in
That's
my
amazing.
Front yard.
That's amazing.
I have one in my backyard.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah, and they might change it. That's not uncommon that they make the estimations based on stuff that people write in, and then once they actually survey the damage, they upgrade or
downgrade. I think it's F2. Yeah. I think
I think you're right. He was right on the cusp, and they probably just said, I'll make it an F1.
Whoa, we had an F2.
You know what comes after F2? An FU.
And F5 is the highest, and that's winds up to 200 miles per hour.
Yeah, that's like cows flying in the air and semi-trucks like ending up not where they were originally parked.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so good job, Bob and Kara.
Yay, Bob.
Woohoo.
Yeah. Tornadoes, they're so interesting.
Yeah, they're so powerful. It is such a powerful act of nature.
They're so intimidating. There's one of the few things in nature that if you see it, I think I'd shit my pants.
Yeah.
But they're also really beautiful. That's the thing. You're transfixed by them.
They are magnificent and terrifying as the dawn. No, they are magnificent and absolutely scary as all hell. Because they're massive Imagine if one's coming at you at 70 miles an hour.
Cannot run that.
You cannot run it. You cannot drive it.
You can't. Probably. And you also don't even know if it's actually coming at you. That's the scary thing. You might think you're riding next to one, and then all of a sudden it turns.
Yeah.
Like, they're so unpredictable. That's why storm chasing is incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, it is like the hand of Thanos. It's like you're spared or not spared, yeah, pretty much at random. Right?
Mm-hmm. All right, I have a quote, because Evan is not available for the show, so I asked Steve if I could do the quote. I spent 30 seconds looking this quote up.
Good job.
Here is the quote: "Science is a beautiful gift to humanity. We should not distort it." That's it's a mouthful. That was from a person called APJ Abdul-Kalam.
Okay.
What just happened?
Is that the first time Kara's ever heard that?
Maybe.
When Jay was doing the quotes, he would shout the name of the person that the quote was by every week. And that was a thing.
He was an Indian statesman, born 1931, died 2015.
And Kalam is my favorite Indian restaurant.
Is that right?
Oh, a former president of India.
Oh, imagine if we had a president who respected science, but don't get me started.
Look at that. And he was an aerospace scientist and professor before he went into politics.
So, guys, we have our Patreon members live stream. So this is the SGU does a live stream that only members have access to. That is happening on Sunday, June 3rd. We'll be doing that at 5 p.m. Eastern time, mm-hmm, which is what time UTC, Bob?
Five hours.
So 10.
Yeah. So 10 p.m. UTC.
2 o'clock Pacific.
So we will be emailing our members the details on how and where they are to.
And we'll put it on the Discord server too.
Yeah. We'll mention this in many different locations for them to see exactly how to dial into that. These events happen once a month, where we do a members-only live stream where they can ask us questions and we have more of a loose form talking about different things that we like and whatever. So we just play it by ear. Whatever the members want to do, we'll do.
And a quick reminder, don't forget about Nexus, the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism in New York City, July 12th through 15th. One of the speakers we'll be having there this year is Rachel Burks. She is a chemistry professor, a forensic scientist, and a science communicator that goes by the pseudonym Dr. Rubidium, which is a great either superhero or supervillain name, depending on your preference. Her current research involves adapting cell phones as portable forensic devices to detect drugs, explosives, and chemical weapons, and she writes a monthly true crime column called Trace Analysis for Chemistry World, the magazine of the Royal Society of Chemistry. She will be talking on Saturday, July 14th at 4:05 p.m. Her talk is entitled, "It Was the Professor in the Library with the Poison." She'll also be appearing on a panel on Sunday. And don't forget, the SGU will be there for our live show, panels, workshops, and meet and greets. So hopefully we'll see a lot of our listeners there. Go to necss.org to look at all the speakers and to register for the conference.
Well, thank you all for joining me this week in our special tornado bunker.
So glad I could dial in, Doc.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org. where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.